for joining us. We need to address what's happening. So two things. I am moving to Denver next week, which means that all of my belongings, including my office and my podcast setup, is in a shipping container, currently getting driven across the country. And I have towels pinned in front of me, and I'm recording.
It looks like Tim has been taken hostage by Al Qaeda and is like being forced to record.
And I have exactly an Al Qaeda flag backdrop behind me, which is a blanket that I propped on a camera tripod and a chair that I moving taped a Swiffer to hold me up. So that's the first announcement. The second announcement is I've been sick as fuck for the last week, strep throat, the whole deal. I've been knocked out, and I'm a little embarrassed to record the episode today because my voice just sounds so froggy, but we have a motto on this show, and that's keep the camera rolling. And so we're recording this bad boy and we're getting it done. So with that being said, we got an exciting episode for you today. Ethan, we bought a company. How do you feel about
a company? I'm excited, man. Actually, I don't know how to feel yet. It hasn't sunk in, but in the brief moments when it does sink in,
yeah,
it feels real. I'm very excited. Can we talk about it for a second? Because you actually really bought the company more than I did. You like handled all the logistics and you got everything done. And I was surprised because I kept seeing the DMs back and forth, and there was a lot more that went into it than I would have thought as somebody who's never bought a piece of software before. Can you just talk people through that? Like, what was that like?
I've never bought a SaaS company before. And so that was definitely a learning curve. I know enough about code to understand what I'm looking at. I don't know shit about databases, and the functionality of our business, of our product, is inside a database. So there's this really cool company called Supabase, exactly how it sounds. And so our data lives within Supabase. And I've been talking to the guy that we bought it from, who's super talented. He's one of the head sales engineers at what is also our hosting platform called Vercel. He built it in a really cool way, which makes it so that every time somebody uses our product, it doesn't actually API call the database. What it does is it tells Twitter to do the job for us. And so when I was looking at the database and all the API calls, I was like, man, if this thing really starts going, our database costs and our API calls are going to be super expensive. He walked me through how we built this thing. He's like, no, I already planned for that. The database doesn't perform any of the API calls other than just creating the API to connect the product to Twitter in the first place. So that was awesome because we were right at the finish line. And I was like, oh man, did I just like totally screw myself on some product that I bought without knowing enough about databases? But we got through that. And other than that, it was pretty seamless. I mean, I know how to do the paperwork. I know how to do the bill of sale. I've been through the whole thing before. And he was a really, really great guy to work with as well. He's been super helpful. And I think he's very busy, and he was excited to just get it off of his plate, you know? And so I feel so confident that the idea that we had is practical. I feel so confident that it's going to be something that people pay for a long time, because the practicality of it is going to make it so that it's valuable. You know, sometimes SaaS companies are like, you're just selling it, and then the churn rate is too high that it never had a chance. And you don't know that until you're like 200 grand in the hole, right? I don't foresee that. I don't foresee this being a high churn company. I see it being pretty lean because it's a very, very targeted buyer who's going to use it. But man, I'm so excited. I've never had a SaaS company before. I've never been in the SaaS game. And so now you and I are official Twitter tech bros.
We're sassy.
Yeah.
And that'll be the last time we say that. But and so I want to clarify the record on one thing. You said the idea that we had, we didn't have it. You had it. This was a great idea.
Yeah, and but you co-signed, man. You co-signed.
Yeah. Well, if I got credit for everything that I approve of, like, I would have a great resume. But for people who maybe didn't hear that episode, quick overview. We bought this micro SaaS company, and the idea is that we're going to use that to monetize the podcast.
Yeah.
Potentially in addition to ads, but potentially on its own as well. And the idea being, once we have it up and running, there's a SaaS product that you could buy, and we just say, hey, this podcast is brought to you by blank, whatever the name is. By the way, I know the name, I'm just not saying it, just in case we decide to change it or something like that. Anyways, we're going to monetize the podcast via SaaS. And Tim pulled this one off. I really encourage people to go back and listen to that episode too, because I listened to it and I thought you did a really good job of talking through not only the idea, but like why this is the future for a lot of creators. So I'm excited. I hope a year from now, I'm not listening to this episode, like living under a bridge going like, what were you thinking? But yeah, man, I'm stoked.
I'm stoked as well. I just really fucking love it. Like, I really love it. I'm so lucky that I just get to play around all day. And I weirdly found this strange skill of like deal tinkering that I'm like weirdly good at. And I don't even really know how you would identify what that skill is, just tinkering and looking for opportunities. And so, I've had a few losses over the last 2 years, and I think I've stacked up enough losses where the probability of this working is higher than it would usually be. So I'm pumped.
Let's hope that that's how the math works. It's like, you know, you reminded me of something that I read this morning too. We talked about this guy, Howard Gossage, a couple of episodes ago, the copywriter. I was going to say Seneca of San Francisco, but it wasn't Seneca. Who's the other philosopher that begins with an S?
Socrates.
That's the guy. The Socrates of San Francisco. Well, I got a couple of books on him because he's so fascinating to me. And one of them is a biography. And I guess he had this saying that he used to say. It was like, whenever anybody asked him about what it was like to be a creative person, he'd say something to the effect of like, well, I don't really think creative people have any choice. It's like they tried a bunch of stuff. Like the reality about being a creative person is not that you like go out into the world and you're just creative and create stuff. It's like, actually you try a bunch of shit and most of it doesn't work out until eventually you stumble into some career path that rewards your creativity. And for him, that was ad copywriting. For you, it seems to be deal tinkering. But when I like first read that, it's like, oh my God, that explains, most of the last 32 years for me.
Yeah, it's a relief to know that. I was very relieved just to learn about the Pareto principle, which is something I talk about all the time, because it gave me pragmatic permission to take a lot of shots, because the act of taking a lot of shots is actually like statistically the best way to do it. And it allowed me to take my ego out of it, where it's like, I actually don't need to know that much about what I'm doing or like be a quant or have this like predictability model. It's just take a bunch of shots and do your best to find an opportunity that like you think is going to work. But the reality is like nobody actually knows what they're doing. Nobody. I mean, 2 years ago, people thought A16Z was like a genius venture company to find out they've dumped like billions of dollars into crypto, when at the time we thought that was genius. But the crazy thing about it is like 3 years from now, it might be genius again, you know? And so like no one knows anything. Everyone's just making it up as they go along. And so learning that has been helpful for me. And also the story of the scorpion and the frog of why did you sting me? He's like, I'm a scorpion, you know, it's in my nature. And I think as I've gotten older, it's been a little easier for me to just be like, it's in my nature. This is just what I have to do. And if I don't do it, it's not like I'm going to look back and think, you know, I really played my cards right. Like, that doesn't make me happy. I'd rather lose a bunch of hands than win a bunch of hands and have fun on the way.
Speaking of figuring it out as we go, you mentioned you had a tweet thread about growing SaaS companies that you wanted to talk about today.
I certainly do. And it was perfect timing because you and I, once the deal was committed to. It wasn't a done deal, but it was, we both committed to signing it. You and I immediately started talking about pricing, and pricing is such a complicated thing because no matter what you do, you could do it differently. And there's no way to know if the other way to do it is actually the right way because you have to choose a way. And so I had this idea of, hey, maybe we just sell the product at a lifetime price. And then you came back with the idea of, I don't think so. I think that would potentially hurt us down the line because if we have like a really amazing product and we can keep our customers for years, then, you know, we'll be way more profitable. And also as an easier path to entry with a monthly fee, which, you know, people can test it. And then you prove to them that your product is worth it. And by the way, I still don't necessarily know. I saw this thread right when we were talking about it. It was the day after. And I just thought, man, this is the sign. And this is something we got to talk about. All right. Kyle Gawley, at Kyle Gawley on Twitter, KyleGawley, had, and it looks like he's a JavaScript coder because he's got .js on the back of his profile, on the back of his handle. It says, controversial opinion, SaaS is an installment plan. Customers don't pay forever. There is a limited lifetime value. It's very hard to capture that full value over many years. I get more excited about high ticket upfront sales, or even better, hybrid. And I saw this word hybrid, and I thought to myself, Substack comes out with the hybrid model where they have the monthly, they have the yearly, and then they have some kind of VIP member where you pay like $200 usually. That's the default on Substack. And then you get lifetime access. I thought that was interesting, but then I also thought, and I couldn't find it, Nathan Berry wrote this thread about pricing and how you structure the pricing to make the middle deal so obviously fucking worth it, like just so obviously the best choice that 90% of your business is going to come from that like middle of the road option. So you just price it in a way where, let's say it's the yearly option, like the yearly option is just so much more bang for your buck, like dollar for dollar, than 12 months of the monthly option. And it's so much less of a commitment than a huge lifetime option. Or those are just examples. I don't know exactly what Nathan said about it, but I'm curious, man, like we got to figure out how to price this thing. And I think it would be really, really fun to think about this idea of hybrid and have experiments with it and see what works. And then everybody else can learn from us.
Yeah. It's interesting. I think, the thing that makes me hesitant about any kind of fixed price model, like I'll say what it is in a second, but I should also just acknowledge that like that's how software used to be sold, right? SaaS is kind of a new concept. The whole idea of for a sure. subscription yeah. for a product is relatively new. What's that?
You would buy a CD and you would get it yeah. in the mail and you'd stick it yeah. in your computer.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So it's not like you know, single price is unprecedented. And I guess, okay, well, let me just lay out what my hesitation is. My hesitation for a fixed price product is support, right? So once somebody pays you once, they expect support. I mean, if you say it's a lifetime purchase, you better support them for life. And I think that very quickly, it only takes a few lifetime people who are a pain in the ass for several people's subscriptions no longer to be paying for themselves, right? Because you're not potentially not recouping that money on a regular basis. But obviously software used to be sold this way. Maybe it's like the hybrid model is a lifetime subscription to that version. And then if you want to upgrade, you pay something else. I don't know. I kind of just want to like read some really good opinions on this. Like I know Profitwell yeah. has a whole bunch of interesting content on how to do this. So maybe if we want to talk about it here, we should probably go away and get like a bunch of opinions from people who have done it before and come back. I don't know. That's my hesitation though, is the support angle. I want to make sure that we're able to support people that they don't feel like they're getting ripped off if the software changes. Like they're expecting to continue paying for it. And then obviously just that, like, yeah, we're setting ourselves up for success in terms of supporting ongoing accounts. I don't know. What are your thoughts? Like,
you just gave me nightmares about something that was so obvious, believe it or not. And this is going to sound as though it's judgy. I'm not judging anybody. Like, I'm on the hook. It's just inconvenient for me because it wasn't something that I necessarily signed up for. But Studio Press, which used to be owned by Copyblogger, still, people who bought the lifetime subscription for Studio Press still email me pissed off because WP Engine, when Copyblogger Media sold Studio Press to WP Engine, WP Engine, of course, took away those lifetime subscriptions.
Yep.
And people still email me. I mean, who knows? 8 years later.
So what you're saying is, because Drew had all the lifetime subscriptions, we could just cut those off and we won't get any support tickets. Because Drew built it. So he'll get all the support. Okay.
I mean, there's others, the other examples of that. Like before the there was a offer of lifetime access to a certification program the Copyblogger sold in like 2006, I think it was. It's probably two or three times a week that I get emails from people saying, I bought my lifetime subscription. And the crazy thing is, I can see that they haven't even logged in for like 5 years. It's just whatever reason, maybe they checked an email address that they were just about to delete that is still in the email list. And then it pops in their head like, oh, where's my lifetime subscription? And I'm just like, fine, like, let me get it for you. But but they literally haven't even used it. It's just, they paid for it. So now they're entitled to it, you know?
Exactly. And yeah, and I think that's my main concern. And I would, I don't know, man, it's like, that's who buys lifetime subscriptions too. It's people who don't want to have to pay over and over again, which I think is kind of an issue because what you're doing, you're banking. Like, let's just take us out of the equation here and we'll expand this out to our listeners because I don't want to, I also don't want people to think that like, we're just making this all about how much money we could possibly make from the software. That's a consideration. Sure. But in terms of you listening to this conversation, try to apply what we're going through to whatever your subscription is. So if you have a newsletter or SaaS or whatever it is, I think you're going to face all these same challenges. Like when you think about the user profile for somebody who wants to pay once for life, why are they making that decision? They're making that decision. They're not making that decision to pay you as much money and support your company as well as possible. They're trying to get the best possible deal, which is fine. That's excusable. But the type of person who's going to prioritize the best possible deal, probably also going to be a giant pain in your ass, right? You want the people who are just like, oh, whatever, I don't care how much it costs. Just sign, just put the credit card on it, right? That's who you want as clients, I think. And then that allows you to also be able to have like, you know, good support for when those things do go wrong. But man, from like the agency days of just dealing with people who want all your attention for the least possible money, I have like scars related to anything that might be lifetime pricing. But I mean, I'm also, I remain open to the possibility of testing it. I think it's important to be open because we're so early at this. That's where my hesitation comes from. You said,
I got two things to say about that.
Oh, go for it. Yeah.
I would rather give somebody their money back and say, like, we don't want you as a customer anymore than to deal with that. I'm just not in a place in my life where I'm ready to do that. I don't care. They might have bought 10 lifetime accounts. Just can't do it. And then also, we're going to blow through this one pretty quickly because I know you got something else you want to talk about, but I found the thread. And this was really, really interesting. I'll skim through it. It's a decent sized thread, but it's Twitter. So I think we can get it done pretty quickly. All right. Nathan Berry. So sorry about my voice, by the way, guys. I'm hanging on. I made $37,000 the first month of selling my ebook, but I almost made a $10,000 mistake. Here's a lesson on pricing that'll make you thousands. This is actually really interesting. In 2012, I launched my first product, the App Design Handbook. but in a hurry to get the product out the door, I almost made a costly mistake. It's a mistake I see entrepreneurs make every day. And this is me. Definitely. I'm always like just in a fucking hurry to publish it. It's not charging too little for your product, although that is a common mistake as well. It's only having one price for your product. I created three pricing tiers for my product, the App Design Handbook. One, the book plus resources. Two, the book plus resources plus videos. Three, the complete package. It made me an extra 15 grand. When you only have one price for your product, you leave a lot of money on the table. Tier-based pricing unlocks various pricing hacks so you can make more money. Here's three advantages of having price tiers. One, pricing for value. We've all heard you should price your product based on what the value it delivers, but value charges for each person. For example, customer one might be a niche iPhone developer. Customer two might be a developer of a very popular iPhone app. That's interesting. Let me finish reading. That makes me think of something. The value is different for these two customers. The customer who would get more value from the product should pay more for it. That's where the multiple prices come in. The developer of the product iPhone app will easily pay more if they think it'll help them, especially if they are using a company credit card. To them, there's no difference between $40 and $170. And to me, I just made four times as much on the sale. Pro tip for pricing for value. Okay, next one. Number two, price anchoring. Customers typically determine worth by comparing it to something similar. This ebook is $199, so this one should be $199 too. We don't want our customers making that comparison, so let's control what they compare it to. That's interesting. If I tell you my book is $39, you need to compare the value to something else. Alone, the book might sound overpriced considering the price of other ebooks. But if I tell you the book is $39, but for $79, you can buy the book plus all these great videos and code samples, now you're not comparing the book to the other book, you're comparing it to the other price. And number three is bracketing. Let's say I add a third option for $169. Through bracketing, I've driven the focus towards the middle package. There it is. Okay, so here's an example. You own a bar, you offer two types of beer. Bargain beer is $180, premium beer is $250. 80% of the people choose premium beer, but you want to increase your revenue. One day you introduce a super bargain beer for $160, 80% buy the $180 beer and the rest buy the $250 beer. Nobody bought the cheapest option. This is no good. You lost revenue because you bracketed your own price down. But what if you bracket up? You remove, and by the way, this is a lot easier if you see the visuals, so watch the video. You remove the $160 beer and replace it with a super premium $340 beer. Most people buy the $240 beer. 10% buy the $340 beer and a small amount pay the $180 beer. By bracketing up, you increase revenue significantly. And then he closes out. But this visual right here, this is the bad boy that I was talking about. Mm-hmm. Where if you create brackets for your pricing, you kind of price out the third tier and you make the first tier seem kind of like for lame people. You know what I mean? And you jack up your revenue by bracketing the second tier as the most valuable. So that's a little long-winded, but what do you think?
Well, I think this is a really cool thread. I have one comment for each of the three strategies. So the concept of charging for value is interesting. I think there's a lot of different ways we could potentially go about that. One that has come up before in conversations so far is usage-based pricing. So somebody who's having like, you know, one auto response sent per month, clearly getting a different level of value out of it than somebody who's getting 100 DMs a day. So that's a potential path to go there. I'm going to relate that to this concept of bracketing, though, which I think is excellent. It seems like there is some nuance in terms of where you set those bracket prices. I'm sure there's a way to just like throw numbers at the wall, be like, okay, well, we're going to do three prices. Here's what they are. We're relatively sure that all three of these would run profitably if people buy them. But I know from experience that ProfitWell has published some great information on how this is actually done. Like a lot of people do pricing experiments wrong, and maybe we should see if we can have somebody in from there. I have a colleague that used to work there just to talk through more of the psychology behind price experiments, because they have some really interesting things to say on this. But I absolutely agree the concept of bracketing. What I think our challenge is how do we figure out what those three prices should be and do it in a way that's really going to work for the business. That's saves us any time, like learning expensive mistakes, maybe if we can, just because we are aware that there's landmines there. The third thing though, is the comparison. And this is, I think, where people have the most opportunity to get creative. When you said that, I started thinking, okay, well, what would we want to benchmark or compare things to? And what comes to mind for me is this is about protecting your focus. So I would get people to start thinking about what is your time worth? What is, and specifically, an automated DM doesn't save you that much time, right? It takes maybe a minute to write this out by hand, but the distraction.
Yeah.
How long does it take to get back into your flow state if you get distracted? How long do people get, like, what's the average black hole time people get sucked into on Twitter? I think there's a whole bunch of interesting numbers there that we could look up and start playing with for the marketing. Like, what, you know, what's your focus worth? How much more could you do in a day if you weren't losing time doing these? And then the other thing that I would explore related to that would be like the value of one of their sales. So, you know, if this brings in even just one client a year for your average agency owner, what's it going to be worth? You know?
Yeah. And those are, I'm sure there's sales terminology for this. I don't know it, but one of the examples you gave is kind of avoiding the downside. And then the other example you gave is creating an upside, you know, in one, you're avoiding distraction and then you're avoiding getting refocused. And in the other one, you're gaining potential sales. And I also think as I was thinking about how I would use it. So I had the most random, crazy viral tweet over the last couple of days. It got almost 10,000 likes. And when I'm telling you that I didn't even try, I had an idea and I put it on Twitter and I woke up the next morning and I had like 10,000 likes. The amount of stacked DMs that I got was fucking preposterous. And so I was thinking to myself, that these are all such good opportunities to drive people to leads because a lot of them signed up for my newsletter. So I was thinking it'd be a wasted opportunity to turn that DM into a newsletter sign up because, I mean, I probably would get a couple more, but a lot of them were already there. Mm-hmm. And plus the context of all of the DMs was like, can you help me? If you're going to send a DM, it's a little bit of an extra step where it's not like, oh, let me follow this guy. Let me keep up with him. It's like, oh, I wonder if like this guy can solve my problem specifically. And so I personally was trying to observe myself and I was noticing that the opportunity there for me was definitely to generate business. It was like such a lead magnet that there was nothing I could do about it. And now, like, you know, the last thing I'm going to do is answer like 150 DMs from people who are probably half spam bots anyway, right? Like, I'm just never going to do that. And so I thought that was really interesting. Whereas what would happen if our software sent people to a sales page to fill out a lead form? I'd probably really have like another two clients right now. I'd probably have at least another $8,000 a month.
That's fascinating. Yeah, I think that's exactly. Well, it's an interesting insight. I hadn't thought about like how a tool like this could be not self-cannibalizing, but the people who are DMing you aren't necessarily always strangers. You know, they're potentially already familiar with you in some way. So that's an interesting thing to think through there. I'm glad to hear you say that. Like even you see some use in this. Like, I think it's, you know, requirement number one is you got to be a user of whatever it is you're selling, you know? And I feel the same way. I would love to use this thing just kind of in my own life to manage inbound a little bit better because I'm awful at responding. I feel so bad about it, you know? So I'm excited, man. I think there's a lot of potential here. What else do we need to think through? So we have it. It's ours. That's good.
Oh yeah, it's ours. And I'm totally, I don't plan to change the name. I think the name is great. It's please DM me. PLZDM.me. The site's already up. You can check it out. PLZDM.me. Please DM me. But I think the other thing we need to think through really is what are the levels to it? Because how can we make it so that there are different tiers? So tier number one, I was thinking is when the automated DM gets sent, you can add one link and the watermark is there. So the please DM.me is part of the links that get responded that are in the automated response. Okay. I was thinking tier two could be something like the watermark link isn't there and you get three links and then that's it. And then maybe tier three is all of them, but maybe we could put together like a pre-built automation that
templates.
Just templates. Like they can get a whole little book full of templates or something to make it easy for them where they don't have to think of anything. They literally just copy and paste. Then all of a sudden they have like an automated sales engine in their Twitter DMs.
Potentially. What do you think about, we could also just stack products on it. Like, I mean, and you know, you can feel free to say no, cause they're your products, but like if they are agency owners that are, potentially using this to drive business, would they get any value from like access to some copy blogger course that already exists? Or I'm not sure what that product landscape looks like right now, but I think that's an option.
I don't think they're just going to be agency owners. I think we're going to have just as many course creators. I mean, the guy that was the original one that I found it on, the studio guy, shit, I forget his name already. He's going to come on the pod, by the way. Let me look it up. Why do I keep forgetting this poor guy's name? Kevin Shen. Yeah. DreamStudioCourse.com. So I think a lot of them are going to be course creators.
He's going to see this episode and have a heart attack.
Yeah.
He'll be like, Tim, I can't help you, man. Like, what's the, this is impossible. And where's Ethan? Is he in his grandmother's basement? That's not going to work. By the way, I'm in a hotel for people who are not watching. It's almost as bad as what Tim's got going on. Yeah, man. I don't know.
This is a mess. I'm like,
well, the next episode is going to be from Colorado, right? Or when do you actually go up there?
No, next episode is going to be on the road. I'm going to be in your spot. So I leave on Wednesday. So today is December 8th and I leave on December 14th, but I don't leave until the afternoon because I got to drive my wife and my kids and our nanny. She's basically flying out there with Jules and staying for a week to help us. So I don't get on the road till like 1 o'clock, 2. And then it's just me and the dog in the open road, which sounds exciting, although I have to drive through Kansas. And I've heard through multiple sources that Kansas is just the fucking worst drive in the whole country. And there's nothing fun about it.
Shout out to our Kansas listeners. I'm going to stick up for Kansas and say that I've enjoyed the ride. I've been through Kansas several times.
I figured you have.
You got it. You need a good audiobook. But you're coming from Tennessee, right? So the thing about Kansas is you can see forever.
Yeah.
So if you haven't done big sky country, Kansas is worth it for that.
The skies. Is that why they call it big sky? Because it's so flat. And so like you can just see the
it's so flat and boring. Yeah. 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 It's big sky country out there, man. So yeah, it'll be different. There's one of the biggest things people notice moving from, you know, like the Eastern corridor to places out west is the blinding sunlight that comes from not being surrounded by huge mountains all the time. So like, you know, Nashville is not super mountainy, but like Tennessee for sure, even that, you know, Eastern corridor, Connecticut, all the way up into New England, it's you got trees and you got mountains in the way. And so when the sun sets, you know, it sets behind something.
Yeah.
Not in Kansas, man. You stare at the sun while it sets. You'll be driving west and you're going to have to use like the sonar method with your wheels on the road to make sure you're still on the highway there. Now, I like that whole middle part of the country. So for our Kansas listener, I guess I got your back.
Well, Isaac's from Kansas, our editor.
Oh, geez.
Great. Yeah, that's exactly why I said it, actually. I'm sure Isaac's going to hear that and he's going to fucking laugh.
You don't fuck with the editing talent, dude. okay, I got to run. This was fun. Next week,
I'm glad we got it done.
Yeah, man. Good to see you and hope you're feeling better next week.
Thanks.
I think we can get even more creative with the studio next week from the car or something like that. So tune in, watch our videos, people. All right. Thanks for everybody for tuning in. This was a blast. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, guys. See you next week.
Later.